All right, we're going to mark the recorder and make sure that we've got a good sound level going. My name is Mary Pace. I am interviewing Jeffrey Ellis this morning on March 6th, 2012 at the Presbyterian Community Center in Louisville, Kentucky. And would you please state your full name?
My name is Jeffrey Ellis. It's really pronounced Joffrey. G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, Joffrey Ellis.
And what is your date of birth?
February 12th, 1940.
1940, and in Louisville, Kentucky?
Louisville, Kentucky.
All right. So today we're going to talk about life in Shepherd Square. And just to get started, tell me a little bit about yourself. What's your occupation?
Well, I'm a pastor in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. I've been in this particular denomination all my life, but I've been pastoring about 21 years. I've been pastoring some in Louisville, some in Elizabethtown. And as I said, now I'm pastoring in Louisville. People have considered me to be a community activist. Okay, I would say that because I'm always interested in how the community is getting along, faring, and things and problems that I can be effective in. I don't mind jumping in and helping. I've worked in government for about 20 years. Started off in the in Kentucky Commission on Human Rights. I was working there, and County Judge Harvey Sloan called me and asked me to come and work for him. And at that time, they had two governments, city and county government. They hadn't merged yet. And so I went to work for him in about 87 or 86, 1986, 87, as his assistant. And I did that with him for 4 years. And then David Armstrong was elected, and I stayed with him as his assistant for about 9 years. And then, of course, he went from county judge to the city of Louisville as mayor, and I stayed with him through that 4 years. And then when they merged government, I began to work for Mary Abison, who was then mayor of, I guess you'd call him mayor of both governments. So that's my government involvement in terms of city government.
What type of work were you doing?
Well, as their assistant, I primarily was focused on issues that were community issues that would come across their desk, or they felt like I needed to go out and either check these things out or investigate them, or community problems in areas of housing, and it was in, you know, those kind of things. And worked a lot with the council people at that time. They were the Board of Aldermen, and so I was kind of an intermediary for the mayors and county judges, and did a lot of representing them in various boards and commissions and places where they either couldn't go or wanted me to serve. So I really operated as a special assistant. And then later on, I was director of community affairs under David Armstrong, and continued in that role throughout city government. Then I went to neighborhoods and became assistant director of neighborhoods in the city of Louisville with David Armstrong when he was mayor. And then out of that, coming into working with Mayor Aberson, I was a community police advocate, a role I didn't really like because what it did, it pitted me against the police. The community would come to me with their problems that they had with the police, and I would take them through the process of being investigated or interviewed with internal affairs, and of course, internal affairs never found the police at fault. And that was one of the things that drove me to go ahead and retire. I was pastoring, and it kind of conflicted with my view of what is right and wrong. So I said, I need to get out of this. This is not where I want to be. So I got out and was full-time pastoring. I came out of government in 2002, I think. And so I'm married. That's some of the things I've done in terms of work. I've been president of the NAACP. Me and a friend of mine, we put together a halfway house for ex-offenders at Flagey High School. And it was the first African-American owned and ran halfway house in the city. There was Dismas House that does a lot of that right now. but we were the first African-American company, as you might say. And we started off in the old Allen Hotel. Now, that'll be something you may run across when you're looking at the history of Louisville. It was the only African-American hotel in the city way back. And probably as far as the hotel's concerned in the 40s, coming up to the 50s. So anyway, we took that over. We bought that. And we ran the halfway house successfully. And when you say successfully for a halfway house, it means the people you take in from prison when you come out on parole don't go back to prison. Well, we were able to do that because my friend, my partner, he was an ex-offender, and he had a mindset that helped us think through working with people coming out of prison. But that was very successful. And then we moved that operation to, Flagey High School in the West End. Mm-hmm.
But when was this? When was this endeavor?
That's going. What you're gonna have me lapsing into mind about a lot of dates. I've just turned 72, and they don't mean anything except that's what 72-year-old people do. They kind of forget dates.
Can you say it was 20 years ago?
Yeah, it was about 20 years ago, over 25 years ago.
Okay.
And we went into Flagey High School in the middle 80s, somewhere in the middle 80s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we were successful there in terms of the recidivism rate and our people and getting them out and keeping them out. But we only were able to stay there about a year because we didn't have a federal contract. We had a state contract. And the state decided to let their people out of prison in another way instead of going to halfway houses. They let them out through regional jails. And that kind of put us out of business. And we thought it was a conspiracy, you know. African-American guys shouldn't be doing that. And we were making, we had a pretty good profit margin. And, but at any rate, I was involved in that. And all along the way, Mary, I would be involved in various community issues. I don't know, maybe housing. At that time, police and the community wasn't getting along too well. African-American community wasn't getting along too well. Our young people were filling their oats and having clashes with the police, and several celebrated cases of police potential abuse. I mean, they killed a guy with handcuffs behind him, and that was kind of controversial. So I was involved with Lewis Coleman, who was a civil rights icon, who's passed on, in that manner, in those kind of issues. And as I said, president of the NAACP. And from president of the NAACP is when I went into government. So I had to kind of shift my responsibilities and role. As I said, I'm married, had seven daughters. One passed away, and one son, and he passed away. And so my wife and I, it was my second marriage, we had two daughters. And so I always say my wife brought all those children under the one wing of my wing, and, you know, this is your dad and all that. So that was really, really beautiful for me. And did a stint in the United States Navy, 4 years in the Navy. And I'm kind of predating, you're going to have to put
right, we're going to go back
go
a little
back
bit.
And put it all together.
So when was this?
Served in the United States Navy, got out of high school in 1957, and I went from 1957 straight into the Navy and served to 1961. I came out of Central High School, of course. What the importance of Central High School is to the African-American community, and I would like to think to the whole community. But at any rate, I came through that experience. Had a scholarship to go to college. Didn't think I wanted to go to college. It was a big mistake, but it's okay. I turned out all right, but should have went. And went to the Navy instead. And Central High School was unique in that for African Americans that came out of Central High School, you had basically a two-year college kind of experience in high school. Now, the teachers were double and triple degree teachers, and it was the old thing about knowing your parents, and you know, you couldn't get away with anything in school that you couldn't get away with at home. That was beautiful experience. It's not there anymore. And so, coming out of Central High School, living at that point in time here in Shepherd Square, Smoketown, it was a rich experience for me. I mean, it was a well-rounded experience. We didn't know that we were in poverty living in Shepherd Square, because Shepherd Square was a step up. I was born in West Louisville on 21st Street, 21st and Walnut at the time, Muhammad Ali now. And we had outdoor toilets. It was in about 1945, 46. I think I moved in Shepherd Square in 1947.
Okay.
And so it was a step up. We had indoor toilets. We had radiators in the house and all of these things. And so it was a step up. And my experience, and I'll probably get to a little bit of that a little later in the interview, but my experience in Shepherd Square, my experience in Smoketown, was so rich and embedded in me that we think that it is, you know, it was an experience lost for some people who didn't go through that in terms of living in other places. Beecher Terrace, another housing project, Park, what was down in Southwick housing project, Cotter Homes housing project. So everybody that lived in projects got something rich, got some experiences out of that they'll never forget. And I guess anybody else that lived anywhere, but when we talk about Shepherd Square, a lot of people, Reverend Summers, William Summers, came out of Shepherd Square, Daryl Owens, these are people that you'll run across their names in history of Louisville, and now some of them are still living.
So you were, you said you were born in the West End.
West End.
Moved to Shepherd Square in 1947.
I think so.
So you're about 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall that move? Who moved with you? Who was in the family?
Well, my family was made up of, and when we were living in the West End, where I was born, we lived in a big house where we were really a family of many. My cousin, my father, my mother, and I. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, my aunt, her kid, my other aunt, and her three kids. Now, I don't know how in the world we lived in that house. Some of them lived upstairs, some of them lived downstairs. But we were all there, and I look back on that and I say, Lord, that was so rich. That was really family for real. Oh, but we lived there all together, and when the projects begin, all the projects in Shepherd Square, all the housing in Shepherd Square wasn't finished then, 47. Just where I moved over on Fenzer Street, and I thought if you wanted to walk over, we could, and I could really nostalgically show you some things that would maybe fit into this, but we don't have to do that if you don't want to do that. It's cold outside. But we begin to break up. The family began to break up. My mother and father with me moved into Shepherd Square. My cousins, they didn't move far away from Shepherd Square, but they didn't live in the projects, but they lived in Smoketown. They moved in Smoketown. Smoketown's a very old African American community, and so a lot of us were really migrating back. Not us, not my age group, but my grandmother and them. They came out of Smoketown. So anyway, we moved out from all those people in that one house. Kind of broke up and divided and moved up here. Now, my mother and father, I was the only child. So my mother worked, my father worked. My father was a bartender, and my mother was she worked in a drugstore, old drugstore, on 12th Street, across the street from Beecher Terrace. She worked two jobs. I can remember that. Sometimes I get very emotional about it because she really raised me by herself. My dad was considered to be an alcoholic. He would drink for about six months and then go on the wagon and don't drink for another 6 months. And you people would say, well, you know, hey, why you drink 6 months and don't drink? His name, nickname was Goody because he was a nice guy other than when he drank and did what he did, whatever. And so they named me Little Goody. That was my nickname. And I don't say that to many people, but you got that, Little Goody. But we moved to Shepherd Square. I'm kind of jumping around, and I'm sure you'll have to put all this together.
Do you know why you moved to Shepherd Square? What precipitated the move out of the house?
Well, I think your house got crowded, first of all. Mm-hmm. You know, and everybody kind of wanted their own place. My aunt with three kids, they wanted, that was a little crowded, and of course, myself and my mother and father, wanted their place. Everybody kind of wanted their place. I don't think anything internally caused us to move. I can't remember it. It was just that everybody wanted to have their own place. Economically, of course, that was after World War II. World War II in the 40s and 47 we're talking about. I can remember some things in World War II. I can remember the bells and things ringing when the war was over. I can remember, I didn't know what was going on. I can remember, they used to call them things, not food stamps, before food stamps, rations. Little ration tickets. You could get a little sugar, you could get this and that. I can't remember those things. But I don't know, Mary. I can't say why we moved, except everybody wanted to move up.
Now, I'm assuming you were renting this property. You all were renting these apartments. Or
you mean the house that we were living in?
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
We definitely didn't own it.
Yeah.
And that's probably why we wanted to get something of our own. And the housing projects presented us with, as we said then, a step up. And I think that's why we moved. It wasn't for a job or anything, because my parents still worked in the West End.
Right.
This was considered the East End, still is.
And it was, when you moved, it was still fairly new, because I think it was opened in '43.
Real
so,
new.
Yeah. So it was considered a move up, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How long were you a resident at Shepherd Square?
Stayed in Shepherd Square until I went to the Navy in 1957.
Okay.
You know, I stayed there.
So about 10 years.
Yeah,
Majority of your childhood, 7 to 17.
Mm-hmm. Through high school, and I went to Jackson Junior High School, which is now Mazique. The whole thing is Mazique. Booker T. Washington Elementary School was there. It was where you, now it's a parking lot. But it, just rich experience. You know, look back, the teachers were so involved with the children. And you were so united, and then, you know, integration of schools took some things away from that experience, but you know, I understand that. But Booker T. Washington is where I went to elementary. Then I was an elementary kid, 7 years old about,
right.
And then from there right to the next big building, which was Jackson Junior High School. It looked like a monster building to me. It was, and had played basketball there and had good experiences educationally. I did well. I was a smart kid, I guess. I was the only kid, so my mother made sure I was a smart kid. I went to church, which was important in our lives, down 18th and Chestnut, Asbury Chapel. Okay, that's where my mother went. So, and my mother did everything in church could be done, missionary, usher, Sunday school teacher, and all of that. So I came up in church. No doubt about it, no question about going to church. Didn't even. I can remember getting on the bus at Jackson and Finzer. I lived on Finzer, 518H Finzer. We talk like that when we see people that was living in Smoketown. We give our house address, and that's kind of our Social Security number.
Right, right. Say it again, 518.
518H Finzer.
H Finzer, mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I can remember getting on the bus at Jackson and Finzer and riding all the way around downtown and getting off right there at 18th Street, right at the church. And that's what we did. We had a car. My father had a car. My mother didn't drive. But while I was living in Smoketown, while I was living in Shepherd Square, I just
describe the apartment itself.
It was a one bedroom apartment. I'd slip on a little let out couch, the kind of couches that that let out into a bed, and. A small bathroom, and now when I look back at how we all got in there, but it's a small bathroom, a moderate-sized kitchen, and a living room with a closet in the living room. We had a TV. You know, we put the screen over to make it look like color. In them days, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers that. But we were one of the families that had a TV. And so all the kids would come over to my house and look at Howdy Doody, you know. Buffalo Bob and all of that, a WHAS thing, which was for kids.
Right.
And the thing I thought about coming here that was so rich, one of the rich things, is that my mother worked two jobs. Now, she would get up early in the morning, get me ready for school, and she would take off and go to work at the land bank then. That's what they called it then. It's a big building still there between... let me see, it's Preston and the next street there, going down. Big land bank, cross street, in the hospital area. Okay. But it wasn't a hospital. It was a federal land bank. Anyway, she worked there and on the running the elevator, the old elevators that had an operator, and you pull the door back and all of that. She's sitting on a little stool, and I think about that, and she, that was part of her arthritis that she had from pulling that door all back, which eventually took her life. She did that. I went to school, walked across the park that's still over there to go to school. Just a whole bunch of kids walking to school, Jackson Junior High School. But that apartment, it was so small, but I didn't realize that. To me, it was again, a step up. And we had a screen door and then a regular door, okay? My mother would go to work, and when I got out of school, I would come and get the key. She would leave the key on the shade string, and you could stick your hand through the mailbox slot on the big door and get the key and go in the house. Everybody did that. Nobody robbed nobody. Nobody went in nobody's house. And so I was called a latchkey kid then. I didn't know I was, but that's what I was. Get the key, go in the house. She wouldn't get off to 6. She wouldn't get off to about 4 o'clock. She would come home and fix me dinner. I never learned to cook. As you know, my wife can attest to that. I can't cook an egg. But at any rate, she'd come home and cook dinner, fix dinner, and then go to a second job, which was 6 o'clock at the drugstore down on 12th and Walnut. Now,
how long would that shift last?
Till 12 o'clock. Okay. So I'm there, right? I'm there by myself, right? But I'm not there by myself. A lady right around the corner in the building that I live, where we go around the other side, and there was an apartment, you know. She was my second mother. She would watch over me, make sure that when it was dark, I was in the house, and make sure I was okay in the house. I would be in the house by myself, look at television, do my schoolwork, be fine. But that's the kind of relationships people had in Shepherd Square. Everybody was family. And so she raised me, and she didn't raise me, she watched me, watched over me. She had 2 kids at the time, and they became my brother and sister. And Miss Ruth Bankston, she's gone, and her husband's gone, and the girl that was raised with me, my sister, because she's gone, the brother's still here. So they watched me, and I thought about that. You know, I was by myself, and wasn't afraid. My mother would get off at 12, and most of the time I was awake, you know, waiting for her to get home, making sure she got home, and she got home. So we went through that. All the time I was maturing in Shepherd Square, one of the highlights was Grace Presbyterian Community Center, which was in over there, still there, the building. That became, again, our second or third parent. We spent all our out-of-school time in that center. They had a basketball team. I played on that. And they didn't have a football team. They had a basketball team, baseball team. So my upbringing was really, among other people that lived in the housing project that were my family, all these people. I was in their house, and, you know, as I said, my mother would go to work at 4 o'clock or 6 o'clock. I would spend time in their house, be in their house, you know, and the lady behind, Miss Ruth, would, you know where I was at. Get dark, I'd be in the house. Now, of course, we did some mischievous things. You know, we had a group of kids that I ran with that all of them are dead except one that were very special to me, very special. It was 6 of us. And we had a gang. And I like the gangs now, but we just 6 guys always were together. And so we circulated all around the housing projects. They kept building them. They were building more and more and stretching out more and more. And I'm looking at that map, and that map kind of lays it out. And, you know, we were just, everybody was family. I don't know how else to say it. We played basketball together. We fought together every once in a while and had girlfriends together and you know, just very close, just in each other's house all the time. I don't know if that goes on now. I really don't, in terms of where young people are being raised. So my experience is, some of the highlights of my experience, I guess, was learning how to skate at Presbyterian Community Center, boxing. I was boxing at the time, and Muhammad Ali was learning and coming up, so he encouraged me to get out of boxing because he was too much. He didn't encourage me to get out. I just say that in jest. I mean, he was so good, I wouldn't. So, boxing ain't for me with him. They had a guy named Fred Stoner, who was everybody's dad. Everybody's dad. Everybody loved Fred Stoner. Well, we didn't know it, but just a sidebar. Fred Stoner was, we always thought he was taking our girlfriends. You know, he was such a well-loved guy, and we thought we were dating, we were girlfriends, we say. Fred's taking our girlfriends, you know. But it was just that everybody loved Fred Stoner, the girls and the boys. And he really was the cause of Muhammad Ali's success in boxing because he trained him. He kept him with him until, I don't know, one of his fights or whatever. Fred couldn't travel anymore. And so Bodini, that crazy guy that Muhammad Ali ended up with, became his trainer. But Fred Stoner, there's no doubt in my mind that he was the cause of Muhammad Ali's boxing success. There were other boxers. Rudolph Stitch was a person that died saving somebody in the Ohio. Somebody was swimming in the Ohio River, and he jumped in to save him. And I think about 6 months later, somebody else was drowning. He jumped in to save him, and he drowned. He would have been a world champion, there's no doubt, in anybody's mind. People like that lived in Shepherd Square.
What'd that mean to you to see folks like that in your neighborhood? Folks that you admired like that.
It was my world. It was my entrance into the world. I mean, they were people that were heroes to me, but they were just normal people. You had guys that were tremendous athletes that lived up here, that played with Central High School and caused it to be the athletic powerhouse that it was. I played. I wasn't exceptionally good. I was just fast, and I played football. But it meant a whole lot. People like Fred Stoner, people like a guy we call Wimpy Smith. These people were just directors in the Presbyterian Community Center, but they meant more to us than that, than just directors. They helped raise us.
Yeah,
they helped. They gave us our values and our morals. We learned it not only from home and church, but from these people. So Presbyterian Community Center is no doubt, in my mind, one of the reasons that I'm whatever I am. A lot of guys messed up, went to jail, you know, all that happened. But I didn't, and the people I ran with, we didn't, because we stayed so close as family. And Presbyterian Community Center was that important. And of course, Bates now, Big Bates is over there, the big church, Bates Baptist Church, was right across the street from Bates, is the old church. I mean, the church provided support for families in the community that it was in. You could walk to church then. Now people drive to church, and the churches don't mean the same thing in their immediate neighborhood as they meant then. Church was extremely important. And even though I was going way downtown to 18th Street from way up here, I had involvement with the churches up here. The Catholic Church was extremely involved, extremely important up here. St. Peter Claver, which is not there anymore, and maybe it's still there, I don't know, the building's there, tremendously important to raising the families and creating opportunities for families. It was all about family. And Trinity AME Church, which sits across from Mosaic, was important. So it didn't make a difference what denomination. The churches interacted with the children. The children were well taken care of, well looked after by every family. You know, I dated a girl that lived in the projects and ended up having three children by her. We never got married. Three children by her, but her family was my family. I was over our house as much as I was home. And my mother didn't worry about me. And that's one thing that I can say, I probably can speak for my mother. If she were here, she would tell you, I never worried about my son. Even though I worked two jobs and I wasn't always there, everybody else helped me take care of him. You know, being the only child, I sometimes felt like I didn't have no brothers and sisters, you know. But everybody I lived around was a brother and a sister. So, Presbyterian Community Center, tremendously important to my upbringing. Jackson Junior High School in Booker T, tremendously important to me in this particular area. And then after I got 15, 16, of course, I started branching, going to other places downtown. And we had a real deep rivalry with what we called In Town, which was simply cross Broadway going east, where the housing projects was, they're gone now. I'll think about it before we get through with the interview. But anyway, there was another housing project over there, so it was always competition. We played basketball out of Presbyterian Community Center because they played in the other community centers. We played them basketball, or softball, or hockey, baseball. So it was always this competition issue going on.
Was it Clarksdale?
Clarksdale. We couldn't go over there and hang around too much, and they couldn't come over and hang around too much. It was a territorial thing. I don't remember, and some people did get killed, you know, in skirmishes, but it wasn't like it is now. People get killed every day in the West End, all sound feels like sometimes. But the competition was keen, and Clarksdale and Shepherd Square was, we would unite if somebody from the West End at that point in time would come to the East End for dances and things like that. We would unite as the East End people from the West End people.
And was Clarksdale considered the West End, right?
Mm-hmm. No, Clarksdale considered
so
the East End.
Okay.
And Shepherd's, Beecher Terrace and Southwick and Cotter Homes and all those places, as far as housing projects, was considered the West End. And so it went like that even in sports, and sports was a part of that territorial kind of thing. So,
Do you recall any challenges? Or at least, yeah, do you recall any challenges
Well,
how those might have been met?
I guess, as I said earlier, Mary, we didn't know if we were poor, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. My mother kept, I know I got a pair of, I wanted a pair of skates, shoe skates. Well, nobody didn't have shoe skates in Shepherd Square. My mother went to pawn shop somewhere and bought me some shoe skates. And, everybody thought I was a king on the hill with these shoe skates. And but the challenge, I think, challenges was living mentally comfortable and emotionally comfortable in a very trying poverty kind of atmosphere. I mean, Shepherd Square was Shepherd Square. Some of our people and some of our friends were living down in around West Louisville, say from around 12th, 13th, 18th, and all around in there were homes. And that's where a lot of our teachers lived in the community, and ministers lived, because they were homes. They were integrating that particular area. So we knew that we were in the housing projects. We knew that. But it was so, the attitude was so close-knit family that we didn't recognize that as a challenge, right? Economically, we saw it as an advantage, because we were in our minds, in somebody's minds, maybe, with people that were in the projects, they were forced to live like that. But we didn't see it like that. We seen it just the opposite. We thought living in the projects and all the kind of emotional relationships you had, and family relationships you had, that was rich for us. When other people might have thought, you know, the project living is not, them people, those people. But we didn't see it that way. So some of the challenges was economic. All of the children lived up there, and families didn't have cars and things that people had in other places. And African-Americans were beginning to work at International Harvester and GE, places like that. Manufacturing was real big, of course, in Louisville. And so some people that worked those jobs had better economics than we did. Most of our parents up here, I think they were in domestic kind of work. I think some of them were pastors. A couple of pastors lived in the projects. Maybe some of the other ones working at manufacturing in International Harvester. As I said, GE and other companies that were in the city then that are not here now. So the other challenge I think that I would speak about is the projects had a significant, I think, amount of, and I don't know, I was going to say a significant amount of single women. or not single women, but women that husbands was rolling stones, if I can use that term. And so the women did a lot of the raising of the children, but I don't know how deep I can get into that, because I can remember a lot of fathers were around. You know, my dad was around too. I mean, he told me, some guy ran me home one day, and he told me, no, you go back out and you deal with that. No, dad, this guy bigger than me, going to beat me up. Go back out there. Made me go back out in the yard, front yard. Front yard looked big, but it wasn't even big as this room. And fight this guy, and that helped me get over my fear, you know, lonely child and all of that, and this guy. But I'm trying to paint a picture where, although they had Blue Moon, which was a joint, we call them joints, places where people drink alcohol and gamble, that place, two or three other places in the East End, and Shepherd, right around Shepherd Square, were here. You know, people didn't get killed and all of that. And those, we would try to sneak in those places when I was 16, 17. And but they all contributed, because when I went off to the Navy, it was another whole world. I mean, good Lord. I went to the Navy, went to Norfolk, went to Great Lakes, Chicago, and did my training. And my mother couldn't come to see me when I graduated, so my aunt came. My aunt lived in California. She was the one that had the three kids. No, she was the one that had one kid, and like me. And she had moved to California, to Los Angeles. And she was a model. And she came to see me, and I got pictures when she came to see me when I graduated, because my mother couldn't come. My mother had to work.
Graduated from?
Boot camp.
Okay.
Boot camp. And from boot camp, I was very sad that my mother couldn't come to see me graduate, because I was on a drill team, which was an achievement coming out of boot camp. But then I went from boot camp. A strange thing happened. I joined the Navy with three other of my friends. We all were going to go on a buddy plan. Well, they was on the buddy plan. For some reason, they had their quota, and I got separated from them. And they went to California to train. Of course, I was in Chicago. And so when I got out of the boot camp, I went to this monster ship. They sent me to a ship. This monster ship was an aircraft carrier. And it was the first of the kind of aircraft carriers that were called super carriers. And it simply had an angled deck. Planes could land and take off at the same time. That was the first of those kind of ships. Well, the ship weighed 69,000 tons. It had about, when everybody was on it, it had about 4,500 people. I mean, it was just, you know, I didn't know what this was. It's an enormous thing. But my smoke town heritage, I think, allowed me to get through that experience of being in the Navy, feeling like, at first, I'm by myself. I don't have any brothers, sisters, I'm in the Navy, and all these people, new people from all over the world, all over the country. So I served in the Navy for 4 years, served on that ship for 4 years. Very, very, very proud of that. Very, very exciting thing. I think people nowadays, they have television shows that talk about and show the life of an aircraft carrier, how it is on it. Tremendously exciting, tremendously dangerous, and it was an experience I'll never forget.
How did how do you think your Smoketown experience helped you?
Well, I was always pretty mild-mannered kid. I never wanted to be fighting and all that stuff. But it caused me to have an edge. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It caused me to have an edge. People didn't take advantage of me, and all that was happening in the military, you know, all kind of people in the military. So it caused me to have, Mary, an edge. Throughout my Navy experience, I met some guys that were from here. We all felt like, I don't know how to really describe it. We all felt like this smoke town experience caused us to walk with a little swagger. And we were proud of it, proud of where we come from. Did not see it as a negative, saw it as a positive. So I think it just helped me become a man, you know, have some basis to become a man with, or from. some of the experiences. One of the most richest experiences out of Smoketown that I can, that I hold on to now, is we had a singing group. Everybody sang out, sat on the basement and sang. Everybody, five guys, you had a singing group. We had one that was pretty serious, we thought. In fact, one of the major groups at the time out of was singing these groups, we call them doo-wop groups, wanted to take us to Chicago. But all of us were still in school, and mother wasn't going to let us, daddies and mama wasn't going to let us go to Chicago. But if we went, we felt like we would have been successful and been in Motown and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We were that good. And
what'd you call yourselves?
The Canaries.
And you were still in Central High School?
Mm-hmm. We sang at Central and sang at all around the town. And a couple of times they let us come in a club, even though we were too young. They let us come in a club or two to sing because we were that good. And there was a lot of other groups around at the time. Everybody had a little group, but I was pretty outstanding. And every time I hear a certain song, I just almost break down and cry because our lead singer, there's a song that we sang that they still play.
What's that?
It's by Bloodstone. And what the heck is the name of it? It's by Bloodstone. I just heard it the other day. I can't think of it right now. What the heck was it? But anyway, I may think of it before the interview's over. But those kind of things, that group, all of those guys, as I said, are dead except one. And he's a pastor, and he was one of the celebrated pastors in this city. His father was, and he got in some trouble with HUD and had to do some prison time. In fact, he'll be getting out soon. And I had a picture. I had the only picture of us. I probably was 100 pictures, but I just have that one picture. And it was myself. I was singing bass. It was Ron Webb is a guy who was singing lead. It was one of the best lead singers around town. It was Otway Mayfield. He sung second tenor. And it was Alfonso Humphrey and his brother, Henry Humphrey, which I'm talking about this pastor. That's five. And then we had another guy that was our... And here's the thing, too, is interesting. This one guy that was a little older than us, say we were 16 then, he was about 18. We seen this guy as our father. I mean, he was just the head of the gang. And I looked back on it and said, this man wasn't but 2 years older than us, and he could get us to do anything. He was our leader, and he was our manager. And then one of the guys in the group had a brother that was one of the part of us, so five, six, seven, really seven of us that just stayed together. You see one, you see the other. You couldn't do something to one and not have to deal with the other. That kind of thing. Oh, that was rich. But that's some of the things that were rich to me. But the challenges, as you ask, and I'll just sum it up, was living economically the way we were and not knowing it and being proud of what we had. You know, I had shoe skates, I had a bicycle, a swing bicycle with a horn, box horn on it. I mean, these are things that kids just valued. All the kind of little clothes I wanted. They used to call me the little well-dressed kid. My mother just dressed me and put a little tie on me and all this. So,
your mom worked two jobs, and do you recall ever feeling any sense of that she wasn't able to meet the bills, pay the rent, getting food? Do you recall struggles in any of those areas?
No. Mm-hmm. So I think about it as you asked, no. She worked two jobs evidently for a reason. I mean, I don't think she just wanted to do that. I think she wanted to provide for a family because my dad didn't always do that. Mm-hmm. He did the best he could when he did. And I have pictures of him and I together at football games and things. He was a pretty good dad, you know, but there would be that time that he would be off drinking and would not come home for 3, 4, 5 months. They would bring him home, cabs and people that knew him would bring him home, put him in the bed. My mother went through all of that. I never saw them fighting and arguing. I'm sure they did, because my mother didn't like his lifestyle. But I guess they kept it away from me. No, Mary, I cannot remember my mother complaining about not having something. We always had...
Or feeling any stress about not being able to make the bills, or...
No, because we still had family, other family in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandmother lived in Beecher Terrace. I went and stayed with her a lot. You know, my mother would try to get me more or less, try to get me out of this Shepherd Square lifestyle. It wasn't bad, but she just wanted me to have other experiences. She'd send me down to Beecher Terrace, and I'd stay there on the weekends because my mother worked on the weekends at the one job. The drugstore job would start on Saturday a little earlier because, you know, the other place was closed on Saturdays and Sundays. But she would work that Saturday job from up. And I could go over to the drugstore, which was at 12th and Walnut. And one of the things that one of the benefits of having my mother work there is that the funny books, comic books, were always new coming in there. And she'd always, every weekend, she'd bring me two or three comic books. So I had a stack of comic books that kept the girls coming to my house. Hey, Jeff, let us see some of your comic books. And the guys, hey, man, let's trade comics. So I was well-liked, if nothing else, because I had the new comic books. Not old ones, but mine were new. And then Ebony Magazine, she would expose me to some of them, you know. And
what was the name of the drugstore, do you recall?
Zack's, Z-A-K-S. Zack's Drugstore. Yeah, sure. And she would bring home ice cream from there. Or else I could go over there while she was working, from being with my grandmother across the street in Beecher Terrace. And go over, and I would sit on a little stool, you know, and people come in, hey, little goody. And I'd get ice, she would feed me ice cream. And so the people that owned the stores, some Jewish people that owned the stores, loved me. And they would hear Willie Mae, my mother's name was Willie Mae. And they would say, Willie Mae, take some of this food or something home for you and your boy. So that was another kind of atmosphere that was rich. We had a grocery store up here. God, what was the name of that grocery store? Matter of fact, the Abersons. Abersons' dad had a grocery store up on Preston.
Was it called Abersons Grocery?
I think it was. I think it was called Abersons Market. You know, a big grocery store, but we thought it was. I think it was, Mary. I'm not sure. You'd have to research that, see what that was called. But anyway, I can remember Jerry. Jerry was obviously a little younger than me, of course. He would deliver the groceries that our parents would buy out of that grocery store, and we didn't have to pay him till next week. Things like that, you know, things don't happen like that anymore. But he would deliver the groceries, come to the houses, African Americans. He'd come right on in. You know, we knew him, Jerry. Come on in, little fat boy. In, come on in here, Jerry. We and he'd bring the groceries in, or his father, and what in the heck? I thought. I didn't think anything about it, but now that I look back, they were delivering the groceries to us. We go pick them out.
Square.
Yeah, they bring the groceries up off of Preston Street up there, and I don't know how they got there, walk, drove, whatever, and bring and deliver the groceries. I mean, that's amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. But I can remember stealing some apples out of Abersons dad's market, and they caught me. I mean, I really didn't steal; I just took the apple and started eating. You know? And his dad, you know, you got to buy that apple. Nickel, something, 2 cents or something. We never paid him. So the relationship was still so rich in camaraderie, even though, and then in the West End, down around Beecher Terrace, and this is really something kind of touchy with me, the Jewish folk, not the Jewish folk is touchy, because they owned all the businesses, okay, in the African-American or black community. That was fine with us. They gave a little, took a little, it was give and take. Now, I'm really concerned, and I don't want this to be a racist kind of a thought or kind of a thing to come over that way, but now I don't know what these guys are, Arabs, I don't know what they are, but they've opened up, they've come into our community, especially the West End, even in the East End, and opened up liquor stores, some grocery stores, liquor, grocery, combined, and they take out of the community, they don't put anything back. In those days, the Jewish people or white people that did have stores, they employed us, and they gave back to the little basketball, baseball teams, and then our parents didn't have money. They could get the food. Obviously, none of that exists anymore. But those things contributed to who I am and what I think about other people. So this group that's moved into the African-American community now bothers me because they bring things in that are not good for our community. In fact, I joined a movement. I was head of a movement in the West End to cause an area to go dry. We made that area go dry to get them people out of there. And so they still fighting us about that. But I don't know how I digress into that. But
what church are you pastor at? What's the name of your church?
I'm pastoring Greater St. James.
Greater St. James.
Greater St. James at 21st and Oak. I didn't know Greater St. James existed when I was coming up, but it did. And I ended up pastoring there. My most productive pastoral life was out in the Bingham area, out around 7th and Algonquin. I went out there when they first thought I was ready to pastor. After 2 years of being in the ministry, you normally go to school, but they thought I was mature because I didn't come into the ministry until I was 49. That's when I began to feel the real call to minister. I really had the call when I was 12, but I just, no. And so when I turned 49, I really gave in to that call to preach and to pastor. And as a result, I was out in the Bingham area, called Bingham area, 7th and Algonquin, and they put me in a church that was falling down. I immediately brought the church up and the people up and then moved them down the street about four blocks to a nice, beautiful church that was formerly white. People moved out, and we moved in and bought that. I stayed there 11 years. And very productive there in terms of producing ministries and other ministers. And then they got the African Methodist Episcopal Church is an itinerant church where you get assigned by a bishop. Every year you come up for assignment. You don't necessarily get assigned every year, but you do come up. And so I got reassigned to Elizabethtown to a brand new church we had built down there, we being the AME Church. And I was assigned down there and loved that ministry, stayed there 4 years. And did a great job there with the people and with the city. Because I've always been very civic-minded. Now, you put me in a city anywhere, I'm going to go find the political part of what makes a city tick and get involved. Because I love politics. People have always tried to get me to run for something. You need to run for the... No, I ain't running for nothing. I've been an administrator with politicians. And so I know that they can't function unless they have good administrators. Probably can't tell a politician that, of course. But I love politics.
Do you think your upbringing in Shepherd Square influenced your love of politics, community work, civic activity?
No doubt.
Tell me about that.
I don't know.
Where's the connection?
That's good. It's a good question. I guess Shepherd Square gave me a snapshot of what was out there. So I was always interested in what was out there and how that worked. Out there meaning, I'm looking at the map, out there meaning outside of Shepherd Square, then outside of West Louisville. I'm always interested in how that was taken care of, what was going on. And I guess when I look back on it, Presbyterian Community Center, the involvement of the Presbyterians in this area is enormous. Still is. We're sitting in, but it was enormous. I can't even tell you how enormous the impact that the Presbyterians through this one mission up here had. It was a church too. And so a lot of things they taught us, they taught the girls sewing, they taught these things, and they taught us, the boys, how to get in and go toward different trades and doctors and lawyers. I mean, they introduce us to things of possibilities all out of this center, and because social workers, I don't know where they came from. I wasn't necessarily Presbyterian. I guess now looking back, it was a social service network that was working in Presbyterian Community Center. They don't have those centers like that anymore, but they have another way they do it. But those things, Mary, caused me to be concerned and interested in how things worked and how government worked. And what can I say? From that, it just matured in me. And so I came back out of the Navy, and as I said, I've described to you, going to work in the government, it just was natural for me. And so, and I still dibble-dabble, and I definitely dibble-dabble in politics in my down in where I live. I live in Sherry Hamilton's district. She just gave me an award for being in something. I'm always getting awards. But I guess Presbyterian Community Center and how it ran. I always wanted to be the director of Presbyterian Community Center. I never did get to that level, but I did run several youth programs. I ran them by getting funded through CETA, an old project, and got funding and wrote grants and worked programs for kids out of Presbyterian Community Center. And they wanted me to be the director one time, but at that point I didn't want to be the director. I wanted to make more money than that. But so, I guess the question I'm just maybe answered the question by saying Presbyterian Community Center nurtured and whet my appetite for being civically involved, socially involved, in helping people develop their lives. Yeah, when I look back on that.
You've seen people take a different path. Mm. You've had some close friends. People have taken different paths. What would you attribute the difference to folks who grew up in Shepherd Square in this community that you're describing, a close-knit community, some folks going one way and some folks going the other way?
Maybe genes. I just. I want to say family. Everybody that moved in Shepherd Square, everybody that lived in the housing projects, didn't think the same way. And I mean, some of the guys I think you're talking not you're talking about, but some of the guys that lived the life that you're asking me, how did that happen? It seemed when I look back, it went back to family. Some kind of way it was a breakdown in their family. Either the dad wasn't there and they ran amok, or something's, you know, it's bad people in every life, in every community, in every environment. But the people that I know that were bad, when I say bad, I mean maybe were thieves, you know, little thieves, and it was probably family. Somewhere it was a breakdown. They didn't want to stay in school, so they got out and became juveniles, juvenile delinquents. And some of them went on off to prison. When I look back, it would have to be family and church. I can see that a loss of any one of those two significantly, a person wouldn't turn out too well. They would get caught up in the world. As I said, the church in this community was important, the Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church and the Baptist, all the churches, Baptist, Methodist, was very important. And if a family was rooted and grounded in church and their kids were going in and out of Presbyterian Community Center, they turned out pretty good. If they wasn't, they didn't. And so I don't want to, you know, cast any dispersion on a family. They might have had things going on internally that we didn't know about. But that's what I can look back and say may have been the difference.
You mentioned earlier that there may have been, you had a sense at times that maybe folks viewed Shepherd Square as, you know, not a good place to live. How'd you get that sense? How'd you pick that up?
That's a tough question because I didn't accept that, but I could feel that. The projects, the bricks, is what they called it. Everybody, it wasn't those at that time, and even now, but the housing projects wasn't a place for you to go and stay. It was set up, I think, in the scheme of things to give people a leg up. People wanted their own homes. People wanted to live in the West End. Everybody didn't want to live in the projects because they were considered to be a step going up. You still got some tea?
No, we're doing good. We're
okay.
Fine.
So it appeared to me, and I had certain indications that folks said, well, you live in the bricks, you live in the projects, you know, you ain't gonna be much. If you did, your folk wouldn't be living there. But that didn't resonate with me because of the richness I've tried to describe to you and the closeness I've tried to describe of the families and people that lived in the projects. And I think now the ones that come out of the projects and made it and whatever made it, mean Daryl Owens and others that have been lawyers and doctors and whatnot, they look back and say, yeah, Smoketown was part of my moral fabric. Now, did he say that then? No. They say that now? Yes, because they developed and they understood. As I said, the projects were not meant for you to go and live there. All, you know, you were expected to go live there 4, 5, 6, 7 years or whatever, and then move up and get you a house somewhere. A lot of the families couldn't and didn't. Did that make them less than anybody? No. Did they have everything everybody else had? No. But they made it. And they made it, and they felt somebody. But I did sense that there was some of that kind of feeling among African Americans. And I'm not sure how white people thought about it. I'm sure they thought, you know, people living over there in the projects, better beware of them. That wasn't true for Shepherd Square, for Smoketown. May have been a little true for Southwick and Carter Homes. They were kind of, we always thought they were kind of wild guys and people down there. Because they had, those projects were built to receive more families, or larger families. They had, I think we only went up to about, I don't know if we had any 3-bedroom apartments up here. I think we went up to 2. Maybe we had several 3. But down in Southwick and Carter Homes, they had 3-bedroom apartments, 4-bedroom apartments. You know, so big, larger families lived there. And, of course, poverty was higher among the larger your family, that, unless you really had something going for you, the more poverty you were living in. So that's what I think came out of some people that thought that projects were not what they were supposed to be. And I'm sure the city and the housing authority had a plan like they've done now. They've moved everybody out. They're gonna take them down and put up different kind of housing. I think that was even then probably the ultimate goal. Nobody knew it. We didn't know it. And I always said this, Mary. Shepherd Square was going to be important to the medical community. I had a vision. I mean, I could see myself. I could look over toward the hospital area and say, you know, that's going to be, we ought to try to do something over here that resonates with that industry over there. If we just folding bed sheets or whatever, whatever. Because I could see that growing over there. And now look at it. You know, it's just, and I don't know if Shepherd Square is going to be important to it. The kind of mixed housing they're going to do, I don't know what plan. As a matter of fact, I stopped the housing authority and asked them to come and explain to the churches and the people in the area their forward view and look. Well, they were doing it anyway, but I wanted to get the churches together so they could establish with the people what was really going on and what was really the plan and what was really, who were really going to be the people to move back in the area. Because the people that, oh, it's so, it's different. Oh, it's different now. Oh, boy. The difference between when I was coming through the housing project and now, as far as east to west, I mean, the killing and the poverty level is so high, and the lack of, one of the things they did for Shepherd Square, they they formed it, they strategically put it together for women without women and children, without husbands, and you know, that's a problem. When they did that, you had men running in and out. You know, the image, the whole family thing broke down. And then the crime and then the drugs. I mean, I don't even, for a while, I didn't even come in this area. We used to could come and the kids was, you know, and they were the young teenagers and young men. Who are you? You know, I'm originally Smoketown. Oh, yeah. No more of that. They don't even understand what the housing projects meant. They had no idea. And the whole strategy changed about who they put in here. And when that changed, oh, Lord, everything changed. I mean, you know, that you could the only way you got in is that you were a single parent kind of a family. Well, that ain't good. Just the opposite when I was coming in. They wanted families, and they got families, and families came. And because everybody I can remember, all my friends had fathers. They lived at home. And shoot, I didn't know what that was. I mean, my dad, like I said, come in and out, going, coming. But mostly he was there. So the attitude then and the attitude now, east to west, that far apart, mm-hmm. about the projects. And when you answer your question, lastly, as you specifically ask, I don't think people thought living in Shepherd Square was that bad. They just knew that we weren't supposed to stay there. We were supposed to move out and get a house or something sometime sooner or later. And if we didn't do that, then the people might think, well, that person don't have no drive. They want, but that person was thought they were living pretty good.
What did you think when you heard that Shepherd Square was coming down? And
I was sad, mm-hmm. but glad, mm-hmm. because what it had turned into, I needed to wipe it out. I was sad because part of my life was going down, and I tell you what I do. When I think I'm getting somewhere, when I think my head begins to swell, I get in my car, and I ride over on Fenzel Street, and I sit out in front of my house, and I cry about the richness and my heritage and all of that, and then I'm back on earth. That's what I do about once every couple of years, once or twice a year.
A way to ground yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So when they said they were going to take, I knew they was coming to take them out sooner or later when they did Clarksdale and they did Southwick and Carter Homes. But look what they put in Southwick and Carter Homes, the Park Duval area, which is beautiful. And Clarksdale, that's good looking. But the people that lived there then are not back. See, you know, that's the problem I had. They moved these people out. They moved them to the West End. I saw spikes in crime and all kind of stuff going on. Because people weren't used to. You live in the projects. If you had a problem in your bathroom, you call the maintenance man. Maintenance man come fix your bathroom. You move down to West End and somebody's rented a house, whoever owns it. You have a problem, you call them. Ain't nobody coming. So you got to do it. So people didn't understand that. They didn't get people ready to do that when they took down Clarksdale. And I hope and pray, and I'm trying to have some impact on how the people think coming out of Shepherd Square. And they've got plans. They socially try to prepare them. But and then a lot of Africans from Africa moved into Shepherd Square. And they got a whole another way of thinking, you know. And it just... But this continues to be... And I don't know how it's going to fit in with who comes, but it's going to always be important, I believe, to children.
The Presbyterian
families.
Community.
Yeah,
Center.
Yeah. It's going to always be important. It's if it goes out and the light goes out, but it's going to be important, I think, to what's coming, and certainly been important to what it's been. I don't know what, and they showed me what they're going to do with that building over there. They're going to make it a senior citizen kind of place. The other building, and that's just going to be, I hope I live to see all that completed. It will be a joy, but a sad. Different emotions.
So when you're in your car and you go over and look at your place there on Fenzel Street, mm-hmm. Let's take that a step further, and you're sitting on that stoop as a 13-year-old boy. What mm-hmm. are you seeing? What do you see out from the stupid at that time?
I see family. I see people that are concerned about each other and willing to invest in each other's safety and well-being. You know, I see a community that is producing people who want something, who aspire to have a better existence than they're having, as we said, as I sit on this stoop, but I also see people that are proud, and I see people that value family and value each other and see each other as family. I mean, kids see each other as my family. And I don't know if that exists like that. I know it don't exist like that now. I mean, kids are so individualistic. Got so much technology that they don't even talk to each other no more. They text each other and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, as a 13-year-old sitting there, you know, I see so much happiness coming out of being there. And I used to sit on my... We used to sit on the basement. The basements were places that was up under. You went down and you had little lockers like down up under the housing, you know, basement. Long basements. And we used to... That was our haunted house. You know, have to go through that long basement. The length of the building.
Did the... Oh, okay. So you could go... The basements weren't... There weren't walls that went between the different apartments in the basement.
No, it was just one building had a... Every building had a basement.
Okay.
And so, you know, you could... And you had storage space down there. Everybody had sort of like a locker. Wasn't even big as this room that you put stuff in.
Right.
And you wouldn't have to put a lock on a locker. Nobody bothered a locker. Put your bicycles in there and stuff. So we used to sit on the entrance to those places, which was a concrete... stoop like, then you go down the stairs and you're in the basement. We set up on here and sang and just growing up there.
Give me three words to describe that come to mind when you think about Shepherd Square.
Family just jumps out at me. Rich relationships along with the family and Presbyterian Community Center. Those things mean so much to me. It has shaped who I am.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, and I just want to ask you if you've got, you know, if there's anything else you want to add to the historical record.
Soon, and very soon, my age group, and a little, say between 70 and 60, are going to be gone. And I hope projects like this can keep that feeling, or can produce, can give a glimpse into the type of lifestyle and life of those people that lived at that time in this area. I hope that can do that, because I think it's important not only to our young people who I don't know, but it's important to that group just above the young people that had parents that came up here. And they know something about it, but they don't know. Their parents are gone, so they don't. Where are they going to get that? That's how important history is, period. So I would hope that this project would be beneficial to an age group that had some emotional ties, but not a lot of information. And that this would produce some information in their lives that would help them to understand not only what their parents and grandparents went through, but why their grandparents and parents thought like they thought. I would hope that this project would do that. And then the last thing I would add that is important to me, that the love that existed in Smoketown when I was living here never goes away. Anybody that lived here during that time and a little bit after that time being my time, felt that and feels that. And when I talk with them, when I see them, it's like old home week. And we talk about family. It just jumps out, family. And that's the neon sign for the times I came up in. Family was extremely important and extremely well received and felt and promoted. So, I don't know what's going to happen. The last of the project seems to be Beach of Terrors. I guess it's on the chopping block too, I would think. But there's got to be more thought about that, because that's the entranceway and the heart to West Louisville. This is not like that. You know where Smoketown got his name from? Anybody ever tell you that?
I think it has to do with bricks. Brick factories? Is that what I...
Yes and yes, but it's another aspect. You're going to hear it. The back factory used to be where now...
Right.
You know, the back factory.
Right,
and
right.
When they brought the bats out from one side on Finzer to take them to the other side on Jacob.
Right.
They have a little cart that a man be driving, a little cart. We hitch on the back of the cart and ride around, and they knew we were back there. They never said anything about it. But one of the, and so smoke coming out of the factories that were located around here. It was some factories. But the other reason is for all, they say that all the gunfire used to go on at times. Now, this is back before me, back before the Shepherd Square. I don't know what was around here then. Houses, you know, little house, little shotgun houses.
Shotgun.
They say they used to have a lot of gunfire. Well, I don't know if that's true, but the old fellas that are gone now used to tell me that all the time. That's what the real smoke town's about, all the gunfire. I think it's what we think the industry is.
Mm-hmm.
It was Bluebird Pie Company was at Jackson and Broadway. The building is still there somewhat on the southwest corner, okay? You want to go and look at that. It's an alley running behind it. And that place that they turned into Lofts, which is on Finzer between Jackson and Preston. Big stack goes up. Those places were places that produce, I'm going to say smoke, but, you know, steam, whatever was coming out. And the bat factory produced a lot of that, because they did a lot of tire for the baseball bats and whatnot. And so you're right about that. That's where the smoke came
from. I mean, weren't there
from.
Kilns and brick factories and kilns in this?
Yeah, but see, that's almost before me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, well, and Smoketown's been, like you said, around, it's been,
oldest,
that's been named.
What did you research to?
I don't know how far, you know, Smoketown, it's been a named area for a long, long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before me, see. So, I Smoketown when I came up. Somebody had already named it that. But I think it was for the kilns and the factories that were around and that produced that kind. And it was, Smoketown was kind of on the whole Smoketown, and Fort Hill is a joining community, was kind of up on a hill, Fort Hill, and it was kind of elevated. So all the smoking stuff, you know, was very visible, and I'm sure that, you know, when they decided to be, I don't even know, I don't know what his first name was, but Shepherd.
William.
William Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
Important. Dr. Little, that had an accident and got killed, I think. Those things that I can't go back that
right.
deep, but you can. I'm sure you will research and find out. So that's it. That's my life in Smoketown. I would hope, again, that it would get to some people who don't understand, their grandmothers and mothers and just probably grandmothers, you know, don't know about them, and they didn't get to tell them about nothing, but they can read this and say, oh, so that's, that's what was going on. That's how they felt. That's why I keep hearing about Smoketown. That's why my great-grandmother, who's about ready to pass on, when I say Smoketown, she lights up. So,
right.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I hope that this...